The first town you hit after leaving London and jumping over the M25 is Basildon. The New Towns Act of 1946, an act to provide for the creation of new towns by means of development corporations and for the purposes connected therewith. Stevenage, Crawley, Bracknell, Hemel Hempstead, Harlow, Aycliffe, Peterlee, Hatfield, Corby, Skelmersdale, Dorley, Redditch, Runcombe, Washington, Milton Keynes. Established in 1948 as a new town to accommodate the London overspill, Basildon has become the barometer of public opinion when trying to gauge the current political climate within the UK. A walk to the job centre in Basildon takes you through these kind of mawkishly planned Brookside-style houses of Langdon Hills, all the way through green country lanes onto Basildon town centre. On past the Woodland School, where in March of 1980, Basildon's own Depeche Mode first performed live here at an under-12s disco. Established under the current austerity-crazed government, Universal Credit has faced continual criticism. Its implementation is part of that of this larger regime that we find ourselves barely able to live under in 21st century Britain. Both sides are being stretched here due to funding cuts, the claimant and the gatekeeper. So during a walk once to the job centre in Basildon, I saw this great figure of a toy of an alien creature from the 1987 movie Predator. So I immediately had to buy this. The figure also functions as a money bank, which is a desperately unimaginative attempt to give this bus some excuse to exist. Curiously, though, the Predator bus bank is painted in a colourful thermal vision, similar to that to the special effect used in the movie when the alien chases down its prey in a rainforest. So is this a visual articulation of the Predator seeing itself? Is it looking in the mirror? Or has the Predator been targeted by someone else or something else, and it's become the prey, it's become the hunted? As I left the store to go sign on, I couldn't really help but think how the current Universal Credit reform has itself become almost predatory. As a system that once positively rewarded you for actively searching for work now negatively punishes you for tasks that are not done, so even the smallest of discrepancies can be punished. It's a top-down system that hunts and preys upon minor inflections in order to penalise and thus save relatively minor sums of money, all in the name of government spending cuts. On the 10th of November 1981, Depeche Mode heroically returned to Basildon, no doubt via the M25. After their first UK tour supporting their debut album Speak and Spell, they performed a homecoming show at the now-closed nightclub Raquel's, just off the dual carriageway. Ian Sinclair says that even in photographs, Raquel's looks like some punishment block of a military prison, a storage unit with crazy serif calligraphy. He also says that mention Basildon to Southenders and they'll die of shame before admitting they've stepped foot in the town. I think maybe if Ian were to actually go to the town himself, I think he'd be taken back by the hardy scent of optimism in the cold, grey air.
For people our age living in Basildon, there's not a lot to do, really. Not enough. It's basically just discotheques, and there's a pool room, and you've got to be a member. Apart from the discos, there's nothing much at all. Even though I still think it's a good town, it's a good town to live in.
Langdon Hills to Langdon, then Basildon to Pitsea, it doesn't really resonate with the same energy of Shinjuku to Shibuya or Tsuribashi to Akihabara. But there is something there. There's some resonance, some trapped vibrations. Spirits sealed away and infused inside these obtuse post-war buildings, lost in Essex, waiting to be found, archived and obsessed over. An apparition of fans or a crowd of ghouls stuck in purgatory, forever queuing for Depeche's homecoming gig at Raquel's. I always thought Depeche sounded quite high-tech, and I love this word high-tech, you never ever hear it anymore. The sound is like a mix of like hard electronic textures with pop-friendly synthetic melodies under moody lyrics about loneliness, isolation and sadness. And there's almost like this phantom of uncomplicated futurism haunting verse and chorus. And there's this kind of weird combination of these normal working class guys dressed up in all this black leather and fetish gear, this contrasting mashup. Their feet are firmly in Baz, but they're reaching out to New York. Their feet are firmly in black and white, and they're reaching out to colour.
I I stand still, stepping on the shady streets, and I watched that man to a stranger. You think you only know me when you turn on the light. Now the room is lit. Red danger. Complicating. Circulating. New life. New life. Operating. Generating. New life. New life.
So when you see all these people kind of copying them in Russia, I've always wondered, what are these people feeling from the music? There's some kind of parallels between Bazardin and the Soviet Union, I guess. Energy from the new town is kind of slivered into the cracks of the waveforms of the audio, and it's ingrained within a spirit, I guess a socialist-leaning spirit at that. So what we see here in Eastern Europe is pop culture being just that. It's popular. It's an entire country listening to a single band, music positively for the masses. Before I was on the dole, I used to work night shifts at this large, huge hotel in Shoreditch. During the Industrial Revolution, Shoreditch was at the epicentre of producing electric lighting and the components needed to keep the lights alive. When the workers unionised in retaliation to their jobs being cut, their motto at the time was, "More light, more power." Over 100 years later, this has been reappropriated by this massive hotel I used to work for, Super Corporate. Their motto, which has now become a slogan, I guess, is "More light, more power." But this is slapped onto t-shirts and coasters and tote bags, overpriced ones at that as well. Hotels are weird because they're kind of in the business of like commodifying downtime and monetizing sleep. And you see, this is because capitalism hates stillness, it hates stationary, craves constant motion and movement and transience and kind of temporality. It chases you into your sleep. I guess like labour markets are kind of built on the functions of like competition, efficiency, productivity and ultimately profitability. So when you're free from the commitment of work, sleep becomes this rare moment of escape. I'd sometimes get home from work from the night shift so knackered and so tired that I'd immediately fall asleep on my couch, only to be dragged into a dream where I was back at work, and I'd always think, they've got me working for free in my sleep. So the future isn't this low-lit, amber-soaked idea of the urban that we were promised by the way of video games and movies. Midgar in Final Fantasy VII, Mega City 1 in Judge Dredd, LA in Blade Runner, New York in The Warriors, New York in Cruising, and New York in Jacob's Ladder, and New York in the Super Mario movie. No. Our urban future is this kind of LED, white, public, come private, Westfield meets the Olympic space. And we were always told that we'd have a cooler future, a better one. We were told that the end of the world would be like this mad, frantic, colossal apocalypse. But in actual fact, the end of the world would be like being left on hold at a call centre. The person you're on hold to is on hold to someone else, and that person as well. We won't even notice the apocalypse has even happened until it's over. And Astra said so. And a three-pointed triangle on her forehead knew this, and she knew this. Ideas of obsession and of fanaticism, and finding applications and uses for these deeply romantic traits. An urge, a craving, a yearning to explore deeper, a desire to exorcise the ghosts temporarily haunting our current state. to find patterns in the welfare state of yesteryear, to use this momentum, this energy, to create something new, to find arrangements of lost information and hidden lore enclosed in widely dispersed popular media. Astra's triangle on her forehead, the 3 points now are aligning as a triptych, each representing one thing, the otaku, welfare woes, and the colour of Hollywood, they're orbiting and they're glowing. And all these moments and all these times, you're feeling like you're the only one, and you're forgetting more things than you'd ever known. Donning face paint, trying to reach out, watching you, watching me, the most beautiful face I've ever seen, sprinting my fingers through your hair, a place for friends, teenagers from outer space, GTA, MTV, and WWE, a haunted Pokemon cartridge, aspiring to be something, wanting to be a copy, trying to replicate the naive archive, sneaking out at night, Coke and Pepsi mixed into the same glass. This time is out of joint, reaching outside, outside of the new town, outside of the UK, outside of humanity, outside of coherence, outside of incoherence, coherent incoherence, becoming obsessed, becoming a fan, capital F, capital A, capital N, becoming an otaku. Late nights, nightmares and fame nights, the gloomy tribe, an overlit future, transformation and transhumanism. We don't suck our cheeks, we have fun. Friends living in Manhattan. Baristas and out-of-work actors living on the 14th floor. The skyline of New York. The Predator seeing itself in its own thermal vision. Charles Dance seeing us, the last action hero. Die Hard, Terminator 2, The Matrix, reaching through the screen, reaching out. Movie sets, real life stopping to watch a fictionalized version of itself play out. The colour of Hollywood. That time you fell in love with a cartoon character. That time I fell in love with you. Never before, never again. Stone Cold Steve Austin, Sting, Ronda Rousey, WrestleMania 17. Finally, The Rock has come back home. Karagaja, raising the war, fanaticism, transformation, longing. The M25, the colour grey, beige, brown, the otaku, welfare woes, and the colour of Hollywood. How Astra worked herself into a shoe. Thank you.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out with Free Cash Radio.
Aventura. So our stealth outfit
really people that are towards the end of their life.
Dry Spell by Marjorie Bernard. I walked because there was no reason for stopping, because it was more intolerable to stay still, and because I wanted to reach the sea. I wanted to wade out into the water and perform some ritual act. I began rubbing my hand across my chin again and listening to my footsteps. The things I had not been thinking came closer. I was coming into the city along Anzac Parade. It was late and quiet. Occasionally a tram passed, an empty, illuminated box leaping on the rails under a crackle of blue sparks. The trees were black, and their leaves made a little dry sound like ghostly butter pats. There were no soft, rounded sounds in the night, only dry, brittle ones, and the pavement was gritty under my feet. My lips tasted of dust as they always did. The torrid street lamps were like sores on the night. Walking alone at night always stimulated my imagination, and now I was exalted as if with fever. But it was the city's fever, not mine. Images, like the empty lit tram, ran through my mind, and I was aware, with a febrile intensity, of my surroundings, immediate and remote. It was the third waterless summer, and the heat had come down like a steel shutter over the city. The winters between had been as bad. Dry, with a parching, unslacked cold. Westerly winds that drove and drove, bringing such clarity to the air that a hill 5 miles away looked near enough to touch. The drought was in everything now, penetrating and changing life like blind roots at work upon a neglected pavement. The colours and quality of the world had been altered in the long months of desiccation. The pattern of existence was pulled awry. Around the city, there was a great fan of desolation. The sun had beaten the emu plains to a black brown on which the isolated houses and the townships themselves drifted like flotsam on a dead sea. The mountains were not blue but purple, a waterless ridge of rocks and shadows with the vegetation, except in the deeper seams of the valleys, mummified and black. Beyond again, the Bathurst Plains were like a petrified sea and very quiet. Further west, in an eternity of their own, were the iron-hard, fissured black soil plains. There was no green anywhere. The stock had been driven away to adjustment over the border long ago, or had died. There was nothing even for the crows, who last year had had their Saturnalia. The country, with its endless aching death, pressed in on the city. The drought and the heat pressed on both. In the city and its environs, its stamp was no less clear. The bush on the outskirts was more than half dead. Even the deep feeders, the black butts and the like, were dying. The life that was left was drawn in and banked down, muted and secret. The scrub was shabby and colourless. Fire had licked through it, leaving patches of black and sharp red-brown. Where there were houses, wide fire breaks had been cut as the only protection. Water could no longer be relied on to combat the fires. These breaks were raw scars, even on the devastated country. They looked like the trail of vengeance. Orchards were long since dead, and the trees fallen on the eroded ground. On the eastern slopes around Dural, the orange trees were burnt black. The flats that used to be vegetable gardens were bare, the last dried stalks blown away. In the wealthy suburbs of the North Shore and Vaucluse, a change had taken place too. It was as if the earth had been squeezed so that all the fine houses that had nestled so comfortably in the contours and in the greenery were forced up into the light. They bulged out exposed, and the sun tore at them. The gardens that had embowered them were perished. Tinder dry, fire had been through many of them, scorching the walls and blistering away any paint that remained. Most of these houses were empty or inhabited as if they were caves, by people who had come in from the stricken country. The owners had fled, not so much from present hardship as from the nebulous threat of the future, the sense of being trapped in a doomed city. The shores of the harbour were lion-coloured, or drab grey. Sandhills showed a vivid whiteness. Only the water was alive and brilliant, and it was salt. In the crowded districts, there was less to perish, but light and air were equally abrasive, changing all surfaces, fading and nullifying all colour. There was no pleasure of touch left anywhere, for the dust was undefeatable. It pulled down pride and effort. The suburbs sagged under an intolerable burden. I was perpetually aware of all this. It accumulated into a black wave which hung over me in threatening suspense. Nothing that I knew had escaped. From my windows, I looked over the golf course that had taken, because it was defenseless, the clearest print of them all. Its silvery green hills were stripped to pale brown and tawny purple. The earth was like starved, sagging flesh on an iron skeleton. Here and there, a fire had run for a few yards before it died for lack of tinder and left a black smear with a little edging of white ash. I used to think that the desert of Arizona looked like that. Now I know that heat and drought can bring even the gentlest country to it. There was a man walking in front of me that I hadn't noticed before. When he passed a lamp, I saw that he was a different shape from the pedestrians you'd expect to see about there. I overhauled him. "Good night, mate."
"Night, mate,"
he answered, as a bushman answers the gate-crashing townsman. He was an old-timer, might have been a fossicker, short and spare, with a wealth of grey whiskers and clothes subdued to use and wont, as only a bushman's can be. "Come far?" I asked him.
"Middling far."
"Where's that?" I felt an insatiable curiosity.
"Back of beyond."
I'd seen hundreds like him, but here there was a sort of long-range persistence that was impressive. His gaunt and bristling dog at heel was cut out of the same stuff. My imagination took a leap. "Did you ever do a parish on the Diamantina?"
"Aye, there. And more places besides.
And now the track runs through the city. He didn't answer. So that was the way of it. I felt coldly sick. Looking back over my shoulder, I saw that there were others, many of them, moving singly, all with the same intent, converging persistence. It would be the same on all the other highways. I took to the middle of the road and almost to my heels. I reached Taylor Square ahead of them. The neon signs were sizzling, and a few shop windows still bulged with light on the indifferent night. There were hardly any people about, but in the narrow, crowded streets at the bottom of the hill there were plenty, sitting on doorsteps or on their chairs dragged out onto the pavement. There was a queue at the pump, with buckets and kerosene tins and even jugs. There was still water in the pipes, brownish stuff with a smell, but the pressure was so poor that it didn't reach the higher levels, so the pumps had been put in where people could come and get it. The city hadn't been used to queues, and they were changing people's outlook. They made new channels for rumour, perhaps for thought. So many things were different, and the men's minds with them. Unemployment was general, either directly from scarcity or from its byproduct of apathy. Idleness was everywhere, and the people were differently distributed. Whole districts were depopulated, whilst others were overcrowded to suffocation. Practically all the food had to be brought in. The government was distributing it as a ration. There was enough, and yet it didn't slake the public appetite. There was a sense of famine. Even those who were eating better than ever before felt it. The whole of our civilization was piled up like a pyre, waiting for the fire to consume it. The city seethed with rumours and with the promulgators of fantastic schemes. No one was fatalistic about the drought. They didn't expect it to break. They even took an inverted pride in it. It, at least, relieved them of the responsibility of living their own lives. There was always a crowd at the General Post Office reading the bulletins that were posted hourly, but no one believed the jargon of lows, depressions, and tropical disturbances, any more than they believed in the bona fides of the clouds that often blanketed the city, as on this night, with their barren oppression. Yet nothing else mattered. All interest in outside events had been discarded, as if it were the most obvious of luxuries. It was obvious that something must come sooner or later of this mass tension, but no one knew what. It was like a long thunderstorm that did not break. Apathy and exasperation were racing one another. I followed the tramline out of the hot and odorous streets. The open space beside the Blind Institute and the Domain beyond were crowded with people in search of air. They were quiet, bivouacked for the night, but never quite still. There was no grass to sit on, only dusty earth. The botanic gardens were the same, ruined between the drought and the trampling people. Authority had long ago given up the thankless task of conserving them. I no longer wanted to get to the water. These febrile cravings died easily. I was just drifting. Did it matter what I did or where I went with these old-timers closing in? The narrow canyons of the city offered no relief. There was nothing for the mind to feed on but nostalgia. I remembered Macquarie Place and had a vision of it as it used to be. The three-cornered garden, the giant Port Jackson figs, dark against the pale, soaring buildings, the zinnias, the cushiony buffalo grass, the statue, I forget its original, declaiming the street, the anchor of the Sirius on a pedestal, Macquarie's obelisk in its bear pit. In the early days, the officers and the higher officials lived round there. It was their compound where the children romped in safety. And in the evening, the regimental band played under those same trees. Lovers counted the southern stars between the leaves, and the gaiety of exiles flourished by candlelight. It was the outpost of something that had had to fall, and it might be again. It was a goal, a place with significance in a meaningless desert, a spot where we might turn at last and resist the invasion. The perishing men who came so quietly and surely through the dust. I hastened my steps like a hungry man who half remembers some forgotten fragment of food and hurries back to ransack his belongings once more. Down I went through narrow, twisting streets between buildings glowing with heat but dead to light. At first sight, Macquarie Place did not seem to be greatly changed. The trees still stood, and the light showed the dark labyrinth of their leaves scarcely breached. It was like all these places, crowded with people. I had the good fortune to find a seat on one of the benches. I was shaking with fatigue. All about were points of light from cigarettes and a murmur of talking. Those crowds had their fits of talking and their fits of silence. I turned to my neighbour and was surprised to see that he was apparently in fancy dress, white breeches, a tailcoat, and a three-cornered bat. He was small and sharp, but fine too. Before I could speak to him, he addressed me.
This is nothing new, sir. It happened before, and worse.
Indeed, said I, not feeling comfortable.
Not so much the drought, though that was bad enough. Even the parrots were dropping dead out of the trees at Rose Hill. But the scarcity, you have no conception, sir, of what it was like then.
Was that long ago? I asked, trembling.
Some time ago. There was the same talk then of abandoning the settlement, but I didn't listen to it. I hope no one listens now. Of course, I've no authority these days, but if I could hang on, surely you could. It was 2.5 years before ships came from England that time. I'd grieve to see my work thrown away now.
I got up hurriedly. Good night, Captain, I said.
Captain General?
A man buttonholed me.
I've been to the observatory every day, but no one will listen to me. In the Book of Revelations...
I broke from him. I hoisted myself onto the pedestal and leaned against the anchor. That was something solid. Two men below me were quarrelling quietly. I tried to speak to them to tell them what would be happening to all of us soon. They both fell silent.
That's right, mate. What we want, solidarity,
said a man beside me, whom I had not noticed. I tried to see his face. Are you real? I asked. He laughed and called down to a friend.
Here's a poor cove gone balmy.
There was a roar of laughter and a screech came up. Don't laugh, you fools. Repent. I sat trembling with rage. Let it happen to them, whatever it was. I wouldn't warn them. Two men were talking over my head. There's a change coming. I've heard that before. It's true this time. I don't hold with this meteorology. It never did anything for us. I don't either. I know this myself. Smell it, see? Feel that? Listen. The country was coming to take its vengeance on the city. Climax, apotheosis, then nothing. Come quickly, come quickly. All ugliness, all corruption will be burned away. There was a crepitation among the leaves. Everybody stood up, stock still. I slid from the pedestal and stood with them. I felt the drops on my face. I was furious. It couldn't come now. It was too late. There were people holding me. It isn't true, I cried. It won't happen. No rain ever. Someone forced me to my knees. There was a great silent ring of people around me. A match was struck and held in a cupped hand. I stared at the asphalt. Great black drops were falling on it, making a pattern like the leaves against the light and coalescing into facing itself. I stared and stared. Out on the roads, that pattern was tangling the feet of the perishing men, turning them back. Nothing would come of it now. Nothing would save us.
Walking like a robin. Take 3 or 4 steps, then stop. Look, smell, taste, touch, and hear. Is there anything to eat? Oh, look, there's some caviar. It must be my birthday. Thanks, I must be very old, like 70. I guess I'm falling apart. I'll just sew myself back together, but will it last? Please take a piece of me back home. Each piece is anti-war. And don't pay your rent. In fact, remember, property is robbery. Give everybody everything. Other birds walk this way too.